Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. This year, The Conduit has partnered with the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation to create a podcast series that explores the meaning of care in different communities around the world. From physicians to directors, community workers to advocates, we will be talking to individuals on the ground to discover answers to the question, what is the point of care? Globally, the color of your skin is a determinant of how well and how long you live. This is true especially in the United States, where persistent inequities caused by systemic racism prevent Black and brown people from having access to quality health care, which leads to poorer health outcomes than their white counterparts. Community health workers may be a solution to the deep health inequities in the United States. Community health workers play a key role in connecting communities to health care in a trusted and culturally competent way, but they struggle to be recognized and integrated into health systems. Today's episode will explore how community-based care can change the trajectory of health for people of color. I'm lucky enough to have two guests joining me today, dialing in from the United States. Denise Octavia-Smith is the founding executive director of the National Association of Community Health Workers. As a community health worker and healthcare administration professional, she designs and implements community-centered strategies to achieve equitable, diverse, and inclusive partnerships, programs, and environments. Maria Lemos is the executive director of Visione Compromiso. Sensitive to cultural differences, Maria is helping to transform the role of promotores, community health workers professionally focused on meeting the diverse needs of Latinx communities, into a widely accepted profession in the United States, as they share the same languages, cultures, and experiences as many native-born and immigrant communities. Welcome to you both, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
So let me start with some brief introductions. It would be great to hear from both of you about the journeys that you're on and how you got here. So Denise, why don't you kick off?
Okay. Well, thanks very much for having me. I'm in the midst of my leadership journey. So let me first just acknowledge that, I have the blessing and great fortune of being the founding executive director of an organization that was launched in April 2019 by CHWs, promotoras, CHRs from tribal nations, and allies from many different sectors who worked and partnered informally to envision a national voice organized in an institution that could lift up, amplify, advocate, and strengthen a diverse community of frontline workers who have deep trust, lived experience, relationship and commitment to community and work across sector to address upstream prevention issues and downstream emergencies, right? Like the COVID-19 pandemic.
Amazing. And Maria?
I would echo what Denise just said, only put a Latino spin on it. We have been, Vicente Compromiso has been around since 1998, 2000. I'm the founding ED of that organization. And it really started when a lot of us who have been working in the community as volunteers, we call ourselves promotoras. And a promotor is someone who has the heart of service. They said, well, we found in our community, it was our mothers and our grandmothers, mostly a woman's activity. And so we found that when we came together, we wanted to learn more and to share. 20 plus years ago, this activity was mostly a volunteer activity. There was very little formal recognition for a community health worker. Maybe they were community health outreach workers in the HIV/AIDS, but very little in the community. So we banded together, and here we are 20 plus years later. We have national presence representing that community leader in the Latino community, although this heart of service exists in every family. There's somebody in the family, whether you're African-American, you're Jewish, you're Native American. This quality that we call spirit of service exists in every community. And so we are now bonding with other racial and ethnic groups to really lift up these wonderful men and women, mostly women, who selflessly are out in the community helping. And our goal as an organization of Visión y Compromiso is really to provide that leadership, the training, and the advocacy to support these wonderful men and women. And now really looking at employment through the community health worker benefit, and we think that employment will lift up families more than any other intervention.
Fabulous. So Denise, I'm going to kick off by asking you, what do you think the role of community healthcare has been throughout the COVID-19 pandemic? And then more broadly, what lessons do you think can be learned, both at a local and a national level, about how community health workers fit into the larger healthcare ecosystem?
Yeah, thanks for the question. Let me start at the end by saying I think we learned here in the United States that the community health worker profession, that its origins, its commitment to community, the lived experience and the assets and strength that comes from lived experience are not well understood, well resourced, well respected. And we learned that through the COVID-19 pandemic. And the reason that I frame it in that way is because the National Association largely has grown up in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, right? We're just over 3 years old as an organization. And the very first webinar that we ever did in March of 2020, which was supposed to be about CHW training and pros and cons of certification, became, an all-out strategy session live with CHWs sharing in the chat their experiences with the COVID-19 pandemic. This is before any funding came. This is before there were any statements made by U.S. organizations or policymakers at the state level to the roles of CHWs. But already, CHWs were defining the deficits around the social determinants of health, the deficits in mental health support, not only for the community, but for CHWs themselves, and the deficits in access to cultural and linguistically appropriate information to communicate the emerging information about the COVID-19 pandemic. That phrase that defines us as frontline workers could not have been more true. The lessons that we learned is that not only are we on the front line, but we must become central to voice the assets and the needs of community, to develop strategies that are culturally aligned, that are trusted, and that are rooted in history and place, and that we must be sustained because the COVID pandemic is now merging with flu and RSV measles outbreaks, et cetera. The need for community trust and relationship is not going away. And so CHWs, promotores, CHRs, peers, aunties, those that are in our workforce are more important than ever.
So Maria, I'd like to ask you about the systemic racial and social inequities that are demonstrably evident in the U.S. healthcare system. And can you talk more specifically about some of the unique health equity challenges that people are facing in your communities, and how these systemic challenges have become embedded?
Well, there are 62 million, give or take a million, Latinos in the United States. And we're treated as if we're a monolith. We're treated as if we're all immigrants, and we're treated as if we're all the same. But a Dominican Latino is very different from a Texas Latino, who's very different from a second generation or from a recent immigrant. And I think that misunderstanding of who our community is, as I must say, is for the Asian Pacific Islander community, for the African American, for every community, we're put in this box. And so the disservice that the healthcare does to us is they treat us the same in their own eyes, how they perceive us. And so if I walk in as a Spanish-speaking immigrant from Mexico, which my parents were, And then another person walks in next to me who's indigenous, who doesn't speak Spanish. And then another one walks in who is a native born, a gangbanger, just as involved. There is no perception on how to be treated equally. They'll look at us by our color. They'll look at us by our history, by our language, by our age. And so the disservice is in the healthcare community is looking at us on very linear, like we're the same. And therefore the treatments are looked at as if we're the same. You know, I want to mention that Denise brought up the pandemic, which is a really important turning point for U.S. healthcare. Promotores are considered now essential workers, promotores and community health workers, which is ironic because we've always been in the community. We've always been providing service. As far back as when I was a child, my mother was a promotora in segregated America. I'm of the age that I grew up in segregated America. And my mother would go out and bring resources into the community. And ironically, my grandmother was the local healer. Well, I say that ironically because here I'm back in the field. But I know I have lived where in an era when it was segregation required us to provide our own resources and our own solutions, as in the African-American community. As in every community, we have the skills and abilities to take care of ourselves, maybe not as a doctor, but certainly as a community healer, a curandera. So I think the medical community does not acknowledge us as being part of the solution. We are saying that we are part of the solution. If you extend the health workforce out to community health workers, promotores, CHRs, acknowledge the important prevention work and continuation of care that we give in the community, then it would be a more respectful way of looking at those of us who have been part of the solution for decades and many, many years.
So I'd like to pivot and ask you, Denise, a question. We know that community-based culturally competent care is particularly important. But how does that insight change the way you administer and provide care? And how do you see both community-based healthcare improving access to quality, culturally congruent care, as well as health outcomes?
Yeah, well, Maria really kicked it off. So let me just say the comments that she just made cannot be overstated. And, you know, very quickly, let me just say the history of the United States for all persons of color, for indigenous tribal nations, of which there are over 570 recognized by the federal government and several hundred that are not recognized by the federal government, for Black Americans, descendants of slaves and immigrants from the continent of Africa, from across Asia, from South Central America, Mexico. We have a complicated history when we talk about those diverse communities in the context of U.S. healthcare, because these healthcare systems were not designed for us. At one point, we could not even access them, regardless of how much money we had or how sick we were. Fast forward that until today, you know, Maria talked about the fact that we have always been essential to our communities. You know, community health workers, and I use that as an umbrella term for brevity, are these bridge builders. We are translators between Western culture, Western ideas of medicine, access to Western systems of health care, and indigenous practices, preventive practices, practices that cost less, that are rooted in community, right? That are rooted in prevention. And so it is very much the case that the community health worker is looking at the individual, their health needs in context, in a cultural context, in a religious context, in a community context, if you don't have access to a gym, if you don't have a gym membership, right, then we have to talk about a different way for you to address your physical well-being. If mental health services, behavioral health services stigmatize you, if they cost too much, if they are not accessible, if they're not culturally appropriate, then we might be talking about religious or spiritual context or community contexts and methods and approaches to address your mental, emotional, and spiritual health, right? So the community health worker outside of specific programs, right? I'm just talking about the individual and our what is passed on, as Maria said, from grandparent to child, is very much a presence, right, of addressing the goals, the perspectives, the beliefs of the person or the family in front of you, right? Not just addressing the program that might be funded by the institution or the organization that you're working for. And so that's why the idea of being a bridge builder, being a translator, not only in a language context, but a cultural context, is so important to ensuring culturally appropriate health services.
I think that's really beautifully put. Maria, can you talk more about the cultural context and history behind Promotores? Compared to other community-based health workers, what makes Promotores' position within a community and their role in addressing health disparities unique?
I think when 20-something years ago, there were not as many titles as there are now. There wasn't community health workers in the umbrella. We were community and we were agency, at least as I understood it 25 years ago. Working for the AIDS office, you were a community health outreach worker, and then there was the community who was doing its work. Since then, the evolution of the role has been, in a way, appropriated by the public health system, and in that it has now designated all these roles and tried to integrate it within a public health system. But the community continues to do its work. And so when you look at, and the discussion goes to funding, to resources, to technical assistance from a public health perspective, it moves into what do they think we need, as opposed to what it is that we need in the community. Promotores, more, we believe, is more community-centered because they can be volunteers or they can be part-time. They don't have necessarily the structured educational system. For instance, my mother had a sixth grade education from Mexico. And if you wanted the best promotor in the world, that is who you would look for. But she didn't speak English to the day she died. So if I put a job description out for community health worker with a high school degree in English speaking, you're not going to get my mother. You will probably get a Spanish speaking non-Latina, which is defeats the purpose of really recruiting from the community. So I think there has to be a recognition of the importance of that skill, that innate skill, that espíritu. How do you, and that's the discussion that we're having in California and in many of the states. How do you quantify that? What are the levels of education and requirements when really what you're looking for is that innate quality, because they're the ones who can reach the community who are well respected. So we focus on that because the system, in particular, the public health system, because that's where the discussion is centered across the U.S. with community health workers, although promotoras are in every sector. We say that there's a role for promotores from preconception to death in every part of the family needs. Because as I'm talking to my teenager about pregnancy prevention and what you should do, blah, blah, and becoming a woman or a young man, I'm also doing the same intervention with an older adult who's, as a matter of fact, we have projects that span preconception to death and anything that impacts a family, because we don't approach it by illness. We approach it by what the family needs are. And that's what a community promotor does. A community health worker is typically funded by a specific project, and that narrows the scope unless that agency is able to integrate it and to really look at how a community health worker can really support the family. Categorical funding has continued to separate the roles of community health workers and even in the community. But we're saying you can't separate that because a community health worker promotor that's hired to talk about diabetes could be and should be the same person that talks to somebody about education for their child and well-being. It is a holistic approach that that community promotor looks at. And so programs in the communities and CBOs are developed accordingly. What we are asking for is in our advocacy is for the public health system to recognize that dotted line. So as Denise mentioned, if the doctor diagnoses me with diabetes and I walk out the door, I don't have money for a gym. There isn't anything nearby. I don't have a bus. There isn't a bus nearby. I don't have a car. What am I going to do? But if instead I'm referred to this little CBO down the street who has a program that we have bioterapia, who has a peer support system, who brings us together, who has cooking classes, how to adapt my Mexican food so that it's healthier. I have to give up chicharrones and carnitas. How do they help me do that? That's a more realistic health system. But there's difficulty in accepting community as a partner. And I think that's where the next iteration is going to be. We have always been a partner. Now recognize us for that and support community-based organizations with funding to hire and provide a living wage to promotoras and community health workers in the community.
So I have a follow-up question for both of you. And perhaps, Denise, you go first. How would you say your personal and familial and cultural background has contributed to your desire to pursue the role of a community health worker and leader in the field? And how have your own experiences connected to this role?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Thank you for coming back to it so that we can, again, honor our elders and our community. For me, my grandmother and my grandfather had one of the only Black-owned, fully operating farms here in Connecticut. My grandfather was from Guntown, Mississippi, and retired from the Navy and moved here and did what he knew to do, which was farm. And I grew up, gathering eggs and milking cows and going to the slaughterhouse and shearing the sheep and growing vegetables and bringing those things to families who were in need. That was the mission and the ministry of my grandmother, who would, bring boxes of food and eggs and sit with people for hours. And I came up understanding that talk therapy and praying with people and hugging them and meeting their basic needs was valuable. It was important. It mattered. My mother, this was my father's mother that I was talking about, my grandmother and the farm. But my mother is Cape Verdean and became, in her professional life, an advocate for HIV. And so by the time I was 11, 12 years old, so that's 1982, I was attending, rallies and distributing condoms and telling my friends that silence equals death and learning that you could become stigmatized, that you could become ostracized, that you could become fearful to a community because of your disease state, that misinformation really could equal death. And that it was important for people who were not living with HIV to become allies of those who were and to rethink the way that we deliver services and the way that we develop policies to protect the least of these, as the Bible says. And so those were, the first 10, 15 years of my life that never left me. So even as I became an artist in my young years, I traveled through Europe and across the United States and different parts of Asia as a performer. I was a singer, an actor, a theater director. I always came back to my art as advocacy. And so by my mid-20s, I just said, you know what, I have a calling that I sort of cannot escape. Let me just sort of give in to this and figure out what this is. And to Maria's point, by that time, it started to emerge in health systems and public health as an outreach worker or community health worker. And very quickly, I sort of dove back into that life and have begun to, you know, develop my place in it ever since.
Wow. That is a perfectly articulated biography. Thank you so much for that. Maria, over to you.
Well, I talk a lot about Manuela, and Manuela was my mother. And I want to emphasize, I grew up in segregated America time. And so we had to, Manuela was the one who really went out in our community and found resources and was the activist. I think of two phrases that I remember about her. One is that, que no me dejo. I'm not going to let this thing happen because it is the circumstance. So she would go out and bring things into our neighborhood. You know, we couldn't cross the freeway. It was that segregated. And she would, no se dejaba. She wouldn't let it happen. So she would go and bring resources in. And then the other one I remember is that I really talk a lot about is que no, si no me levanto, no me levanto, which means if I don't get up and do something, I'm going to just sit there and die because I'm not going to get up and do something. So she was already an activist talking about her own well-being, but our community. She never considered herself that. But what I learned from her and from my grandmother and other women in my community was we were a very loving, supportive community. And a lot of resources. So I had an uncle who could take care of the house. I had another uncle who could take care of the car. And in our community, we had all these resources that we, by nature of segregation, had to develop. And we were resourceful. So I never had to look outside and think that I had to go outside until desegregation. And then our resources went away. We had to cross the freeway to get somewhere, when there was no bus line or anything. The inequities of desegregation, then we realized that. My mother always wanted me to not work as hard as they did. We were farm workers. We worked the fields. My mother cleaned houses. She cooked. She did everything. This is a 4'11" little lady who was hard as nails. She didn't want me. This is the American dream. She didn't want me to work as hard as her. So I was fortunate enough to go to college, and I became a bureaucrat. I worked in the state system. And then I had my son, my last child, and I stayed home. And I kind of bumped into these whole promotoras who were doing work. And what changed my mind about the trajectory of my work is that when I entered a room, I convened a conference for HIV/AIDS and promotoras. When I entered the room, I felt at home, and I had not felt that before. I felt my mother. I felt my grandmother. All the faces and the people felt very familiar to me because that's how I grew up. And I think that's important because we change over generations. Our communities change so much. So my mother, the way my mother is, the way I am, the way my children are, we all just that natural adaptation into the world. We all change. But you always can go back to that grandmother. You always, like right now, there's a food that I love called capirotada, and you only make it during Easter. I can't cook with a darn. But I can go to a señora who knows how to make that because she came from Mexico, and she makes it the way my mother made it. So the history, I think what influences a lot of us is our history and our community. My mother's gone, but I can now go somewhere else, another promotora who has the same kind of feeling. And so besides the important work that we as promotoras and community health workers do in outreach, education, prevention, it's also the continuation of that tradition so that the tradition doesn't stop honoring it. We honor promotoras, whether they're educated, uneducated, if they come off the fields and they're working, that's not the important part. The important part is, what's your heart say? Are you reaching community? Are you changing? Are you educating the young people to honor their history and who they are? Otherwise, we'll continue to crank out all these highly educated professionals who don't have an idea about how to talk to an older adult, how what makes social change, how do you enter into a community and respectfully in a way, how do you know the difference between a Mixteco and a Tex-Mex? You know, all these things are really important, but if you don't know that, and I think that's what Denise is talking about also, is the importance of our culture, our heredity, and valuing these wonderful people who have been around forever, and hopefully they'll stay with us forever.
So I want to ask you both a kind of closing question. You've both spoken so eloquently about history, culture, iniquity, representation in the context of healthcare systems. And I'd like you to choose an innovation that you've noticed or developed or worked on in the field that you think is helping to respond to this history in an appropriate way. And tell me a little bit more about that. And perhaps, Denise, you'd like to go first.
Oh, wow. Well, let me first go back again to my rearing as a CHW and some of the early work that I was able to do. And it was also in HIV, although a few decades later than when Maria started. She's the OG in the room. But for me, an innovation that I think is still very relevant today as it concerns programs that are funded by the federal government and come through our state and local health departments are the Ryan White programs. Now, I cannot speak for how they are implemented across the country, but there were many innovations and sort of offshoots of them. One of them was something called the evidence-based interventions. I remember there was a sort of a compendium of different interventions that were available for very specific cultures, communities, sexual identities, gender identities, folks who were IV drug users and Latina living in urban areas who were just men, right? There were all of these specific approaches to addressing stigma, access to services, holistic services, coordination of services that we don't see as often. And they were really demands that were put on the system not to approach addressing persons living with HIV in the same way, right? Another innovation from HIV that was very local, again, to Hartford, where I was working, was this idea that housing, insurance, primary care, behavioral health, substance use, that those service providers would come together with CHWs, or at that time they were outreach workers or early intervention specialists, and talk holistically about the needs of that individual, that case. Right. And think about how one set of services might impact the other, creating barriers or opportunities. So those are things that were important to me that I learned early on that I still don't think we have fully embraced. Right. For the last several decades, we've still been talking about clinical or community integration or value based. What does that really mean? And to me, it is person centered, patient centered, client centered, community centered. So let me stop there because I still think we have lessons to learn from decades ago that we haven't really brought forward.
Amazing. Maria, please, over to you.
I think that there are times when we have sporadic genius in our public health system. I think what Denise mentioned was a great example. They saw, you know, I worked in San Francisco AIDS office and the urgency of the moment and also the political will, you know, the gay community to force recognition for changes. In that regard, this conference in 1998 changed the pendulum for us for the AIDS work, because promotores were saying that they were saying things contrary to the epidemic. And I think this is the influence that promotores have had. For instance, they said that that this national policy was that women who become positive is because they're a sex worker or a drug user. And the promotores were saying, wait a minute, it's because men come, get infected, and they infect the woman. It has nothing to do with it. So it changed that perspective. And it also changed the idea that men have sex with men, you have to be gay. No, men have sex with men. And so it started to change the perspective, and the input of promotores at the community level started to be respected. I think for many years afterwards, that's the way it was. And then something happened in, I think the Janice is really good in describing these new theories that come up. And the theories, I don't know who develops them. I don't know who comes up with them, but all of a sudden they're implemented. And we at the community level have nothing to say about it. And we're kind of caught in the middle of this wave of a new theory and a new policy and a new evidence-based something that has been paid for by a foundation or by somebody. And what I tell, when I talk to county officials, to state officials, is I think to really personalize how you're going to treat people. Think of your mother. I go back to my mom. What do you want for your mother? What kind of care, what kind of prevention, what kind of solution do you want for her? And whatever system you're developing in an intellectual, it's the intellectualization of care. Is that going to work for your mother? Will she understand the language? Will she be able to adhere to it? Does it benefit her? Or is it just a practice? And I think that's what public health in particular and other systems is the intellectualization of something that's inherently good. Right now, it is the community health worker promotor. And the intellectualization of that means the certification. Why does it have to be so complicated? Why does it have to have so many requirements? We're really talking about that one-to-one relationship that we value. And yet systems and people are adding all this stuff to it. It's that process that gets in the way of something that's really good. And so right now, that's the biggest thing that's up for discussion. We will overcome that also as we overcome all these other barriers. And promotores will continue to do the work that they're doing at the local level. It's not going to stop that, but it will slow it down. And it will not give honor and funding and payment at work, which is really important to those who are doing it, who are the most important. So that whole systems piece and who drives it and is it relevant, I think has been one of the biggest changes. And I've seen it over, you know, I've been working for 50 years or something, and I've seen it, it goes in phases. You know, it becomes intellectual, then it becomes community, then it becomes intellectual, it becomes community. It kind of depends on who's leading the charge or what new university has developed, taken what works at the community and, you know, reiterated it in something, some other language. And I keep saying to people, we're at the community, look to us. We're creative, we're smart. We've been doing this forever. We know how to work around systems. And yet, we're the last ones to be asked for information and for input.
Well, thank you both for that extraordinarily insightful conversation, for your voice, for your representation, for the quality of the care that you've delivered, and for your efforts to try and write a long history of inequity and create a more just and more representative society for those people who need it most. So I'm really delighted to have been able to talk to you both.
Thank you very much. Good to see you, Denise.
Always a pleasure to spend time with Maria. And I just want to thank her not only for her decades of service and advocacy, but her mentorship as well. Maria, I don't even think she mentioned that she is a recent past member of the National Association of Community Health Workers Board. And it was an honor to serve with her in that capacity. And I just thank her for her leadership and mentorship.
Thank you, Denise. Thank you.
Wonderful concluding words. So thank you so much. Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations in partnership with the Johnson & Johnson Center for Health Worker Innovation. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information about the Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.